Blog Talk Radio.
Today's sponsor of Southern Sense is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audible entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Southern Sense.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud, American. American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room or grab your phones. Call in and join the conversation. Help us to restore the Republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud, American. 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 American.
Welcome to another episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio, Pundit Press, Kinetic Hi-Fi, The Fix FM, Patriot Radio Network, TeaPartyCommunity.com, Ghostfighter Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with my dashing co-host, Dan the Butcher, and my suave, sophisticated, oh-so-attractive other co-host, Kel Fritzy. Good afternoon, everyone.
Annie, Dan.
Hey. Good afternoon, Kel and Annie.
Oh, man. I think I'm still feeling the residuals of yesterday's full moon. It's just been one of those wacko days.
You too? I went to go do my show yesterday, 10 minutes to air, right? And get a, you know, I'm here, I, you know, I'm all ready to go. Computer froze. Warm booted it.
Oh,
restarted
no.
It twice. Wouldn't unfreeze. Had to cold boot it. Pages would not unfreeze. Thankfully, I have a fantastic co-host by the name of Tim Burton, and he opens up the studio, and so I'm frantically Skyping him saying, I can't get in, I can't get in. What's the guest call-in number? And he's saying, he's teasing me. He's such a brat. He's saying, I said, unmute me. And he's thinking about it.
Well, I want to welcome everyone here. We've got ourselves a fantastic guest who's right smack in the heart of union busting. She's from Minnesota. Her name is Jennifer Parrish, and she has been working with others tirelessly to get the unions out of your home. you know, the home health care and the child care unions that they have parents, you know, having to force to go into. She will be joining us a quarter after the hour. But, you know, we've got so much that we can go into. I want to do my dedication, and actually I've expanded it a little bit because our show is going to be dedicated to the only woman who has ever received the Medal of Honor, Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, but also the founder of Chick-fil-A, Truett Cathy, passed away yesterday morning, and I want to speak a little bit about that too. So ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you in the chat room. Thank you for joining us, and those who are listening in on your smartphones, iPads, and whatever else, as well as calling in to listen, I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to have an exciting show here. You guys and gals ready?
He sure
yes.
is.
All right. Well, we will dedicate the show here to Dr. Mary Walker, a Civil War surgeon. She's the sole woman to have been awarded the Medal of Honor that she received this prestigious award at a time when women's roles were strictly circumscribed, made her especially significant. Walker, born in Syracuse, New York, to free-thinking abolitionist parents, graduated from medical school in 1855 at the age of 23, when only a handful of women in the country were qualified medical doctors. When the Civil War started in 1861, she traveled to Washington, D.C. to offer her services as a physician to the Army hospital commanders. However, they were not ready to accept a female physician on staff. Unable to find a paying position, Walker volunteered as a doctor at Indiana Hospital in Washington, D.C. The medical officer in charge of the hospital, Dr. J.N. Green, was so desperate for help that he ignored Walker's gender. She had graduated from a medical school, he said, and that was enough for him. However, he was unable to convince his superiors to pay her a salary. Walker worked as a volunteer for as long as she could afford to do so, gaining experience in military medicine, and then went to New York City where she earned a second medical diploma. She then returned to Washington, hoping that her new qualifications would enable her to secure a commission as a medical officer with the Army, or at least a salary position. When she was unable to find a position in D.C., she went to the front lines where she knew her services would be needed. She worked in a volunteer capacity in Warrenton, Virginia, and later Fredericksburg, Virginia. She labored ceaselessly, receiving only a tent and food for her efforts. Without a commission, she had no status, which meant that her opinions and suggestions met with little respect. For example, she disapproved of the frequency of amputations conducted by Army physicians, believing some of them unnecessary. The attitude irritated her colleagues and did little to help her in her quest for a commission. Finally, early 1864, she was a surgeon to the 52nd Ohio Volunteers. The regiment at winter quarters near Chattanooga, Tennessee, was desperate for an assistant surgeon. The previous one had just died. Part of her responsibilities entailed caring for the surrounding civilian population. Courageously, she traveled to whatever area she was needed, paying little attention to the line between Union and Confederate territory. On April 10th, she took a wrong road, encountered an enemy sentry, and immediately surrendered. She was imprisoned in Richmond, Virginia, at a military prison named Castle Thunder. The prison was overcrowded and dirty. Many of the inmates were sick, but the authorities would not allow Walker to doctor them. Most of the food was spoiled, and Walker herself became ill. She was released in a POW exchange on August 12, 1864. As a result of her incarceration, she suffered vision problems that later in life prevented her from practicing medicine. On her release from prison, she accepted another position under contract as acting assistant surgeon with the Army. She was assigned to Louisville, Tennessee, female prison, to care for the inmates there. The prison housed Confederate women held on suspicion of spying and other anti-Union activities. Here she quickly annoyed prison officials by trying to help the inmates as much as possible. Her attitude did not make her popular with the patients, however, who disliked Walker simply because she was a woman. Women themselves believed they should not be doctors. Fiercely trying to protect their own status as ladies, they were offended by the pants and full-length tunic Walker wore to work in, calling Walker an anomalous creature. They refused to trust her to take the medication she prescribed. Many wrote letters of complaint to prison officials, asking for a man doctor or none at all. After the war, President Andrew Johnson granted Dr. Walker the Medal of Honor for her untiring efforts on behalf of the government and her devotion and patriotic zeal to sick and wounded soldiers both in the field and in the hospitals to the detriment of her own health. He also mentioned the hardships of Walker had endured as a prisoner of war. Walker delighted with the medal and wore it constantly. And I want to, excuse me, I seem to be losing my voice. So we will complete the dedication and we'll come back and we'll talk about Truett Cathy. So I dedicate this show to Dr. Walker with the song, My Name is America. God bless everyone who serves our country.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. My strength was not taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up.
America. And I just got my voice back. Boy, that was strange. Oh, man.
What was that voice?
That was really weird. I don't think I could have said one more word unless I just had to go and run and try to get something to clear my throat. But I want to thank everyone for the tolerating What a disaster. Anyway, man. Yesterday morning, Truett Cathy had passed away. He's a 93-year-old owner and founder of Chick-fil-A. And he was in the center of all the conflict having to do with Obamacare and freedom of religion and so forth. And I looked at some of the postings that were put up online and some of the vitriol that was hurled at him and the comments that were made just absolutely sickened me. I don't know why, you know, they have to be so vicious and cruel. You know, this is someone's father, someone's brother, this is someone's friend, and I wouldn't do it to, you know, someone. If I didn't like someone, I would just simply keep my mouth shut. Yeah, it's the most gracious thing you can possibly do. But to hurl the comments that made just broke my heart. And I had gone up onto the Chick-fil-A site, and now Dan Cathy, who's been running the business since, I believe, 2001 or 2003, and I posted up in his blog the following. I said, many hearts are heavy with the passing of Truett at this time as I read and hear the vitriol hurled against your brave and Christian father. I cry for you, and I pray you maintain your faith and strength. To them I will hold in my heart Romans 13:8. Owe to no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. Any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. May God hold Truett in his loving hands and bless you and your family with love and strength in your time of sorrow. And that was signed by myself and you both, host and producer of Southern Sense.
Nice, Annie. Very, very nice.
Very nice.
And,
very
and
nice,
you know
Amy.
What? Obama, we got some news for you. Yeah, he built that.
All right, I do believe we have our guest in on the line. Area code 507, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. Is this Jennifer?
Hi, it is.
Hi, Jennifer. Welcome aboard. Glad to have you here today.
Glad to be here.
All right. Excuse me. You have to pardon me. I have been losing my voice all day, so if I'm sounding a little froggy, I'm going to have my co-host Dan or Kel to step in. Ken, just for a second.
No worries.
Oh, you bet.
We will.
Jennifer, welcome to the show today. We're glad to have you. I'm going to ask a question just right off the bat with this is, because I understand right, you are fighting to keep the unions out of, basically out of people caring for their own children in their homes. There's been a big movement to unionize parents that are actually taking care of their own sick children in their homes. And it's also moved into other areas such as of adult children that are taking care of their own parents in their home that may have to have medical care and needs. And there's been a movement that to actually try to unionize these private individuals who are caring for other individuals in their home. So why don't you elaborate a little bit on what is taking place with that, the fight that you're undertaking to help prevent this, and what has happened, you know, so far in preventing this from happening?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of different sides to this. I'm a child care provider, and I, as such, run a small child care business from home. So I take care of other people's children, healthy children that, you know, parents come to me, they pay weekly tuition, and it's a business. It's a small business in every sense of the meaning. And they have been trying since 2005 to unionize these private child care businesses in Minnesota, and they've been successful at doing this in other states. It's brought them tens of millions of dollars on the child care front. And so far, we're still union-free here in Minnesota. There's been a couple of different developments. Originally, when they first started to try to unionize us in 2005, we had a Republican governor at the time. You know, we got enough heads up that this was coming where we were able to educate our lawmakers and the governor, you know, said, absolutely not, I wouldn't support something like this. And after that, the unions went away. There was two unions trying to organize child care providers here in Minnesota. And fast forward to 2011, Governor Mark Dayton takes office. And with less than a month after he took office, we received a notice from the unions that this governor had already promised to unionize child care providers through an executive order. So it wasn't even going to go through the legislative process. And he followed through with that promise in November of 2011. That particular executive order was struck down in court based on the grounds that the governor did not have the authority to issue an executive order like that. The judge ruled that if child care unionization was supposed to happen, it would have to go through the legislative process because the governor cannot write law. So that was tossed out. At the time, we had a Republican majority in both the House and the Senate in our state. And the following election cycle in 2012, we lost our majority in both the House and the Senate. So we were under total DFL control, Democrat control here in Minnesota, and they wasted no time. By February, they had introduced legislation that unionized not only child care providers, but also home care providers, and that was what you had spoken about earlier with the parents caring for children, their own children, right, with severe disabilities out of their own homes. Just a little bit of background on that. Many years ago, you know, I have an uncle who is severely handicapped. He is completely dependent and reliant on caretakers, is not able to take care of himself at all. Back when he was born 50-some years ago, immediately parents were expected to institutionalize their children because they didn't have the means to take care of someone with such a significant disability. It's very costly, tens of thousands of dollars a year in equipment and medications and supervision. And, later on, more towards the 80s and 90s, I believe, they started implementing, rather than having the states pay for these institutionalizing these children, the state figured it would be more cost effective to allow parents to pay parents a small stipend to help cover the cost of that expensive care and keep the children at home, thus saving the government money and keeping the children out of institutions. That program is a government funded program. It's federal dollars, and I believe there's some state dollars mixed in there as well, and it's through Medicaid. The unions saw that as a prime target, that these parents were being paid government dollars, but they weren't enrolled in government unions. They were not government employees in any way, shape, or form. They care for their own children. They were just merely receiving a stipend to help cover the cost of care. And but that didn't stop them. The union saw this as a prime opportunity to increase their ranks and get millions of dollars a year in funding. So they convinced some lawmakers, and in some cases it was merely a governor writing an executive order, to reclassify these private individuals as employees of the state, but for the sole purpose of unionization. It wasn't for any other purpose. They didn't receive any public benefits. They didn't receive, any paid breaks or anything like that government workers typically get. They were merely government workers in name only and for the sole purpose of being able to extract union dues from this program intended to help some of our most vulnerable citizens, and then divert those monies to the union in the form of dues. And it's been a very successful venture for them. They have, we estimate that they have gotten probably over $800 million, since they started this, pulled from both the Medicaid program and the Child Care Assistance Program, diverted to these unions, and it could actually be closer to $1 billion that they've taken out of these government programs intended to help needy families, and it's one of the more disgusting, deplorable things that people, have heard of. And now there's been some developments. You can interrupt me at any time and ask questions if you'd like.
Jennifer, this is Annie. I'm sorry. My voice keeps on going in and out, so I have to apologize for that. Just happened very suddenly. But there's a lot of questions I have to go about that, because there was a recent case, Harris versus Quinn, involving the SEIU, and there's a group that has been doing pro bono work for all of these child care providers, not only child care, but home care providers, child care and home care. And it's the National Right to Work, and they have a website called National Right to Work. They could look at it. And they're doing all this pro bono work, and they're also following up through on that. And they were the ones that fought Harris versus Quinn to the Supreme Court. And that's one of the things that brought you to my attention. And in that one, they had said that in that case alone, and I believe that was the state of Illinois, they got $11 million per year. Now, if 21 states had unionized, now we're down to 14. So now we have the Supreme Court challenge. How were you involved in the state of Minnesota in your lawsuit?
Sure. So our lawsuit here, Parrish versus Dayton, is brought by the same outfit that you mentioned, National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, and they've been phenomenal. I mean, they have been probably, you know, we work with dozens of organizations across the country through this, and they really have been the experts on this type of unionization. They brought that Harris versus Quinn case, I believe it was in 2010, somewhere around there, on behalf of Pam Harris and I believe eight or nine other home care providers. And in that case, they challenged the mandatory compulsory fees, so what the union calls fair share fees, and that those were a violation of the home care provider's First Amendment rights. That case sat before the Supreme Court, I think it was close to 2 years. I think it was conferenced five times before the Supreme Court finally picked it up, and they picked it up almost a year ago in October 1st, and the oral arguments were in January of this year. And June 30th, we got the ruling back on that, and the Supreme Court agreed that those compulsory fees, those fair share fees, were a violation of the First Amendment rights of those home care providers. So across the country now, National Right to Work is bringing cases on behalf of home care and child care providers using Harris versus Quinn as legal precedent because, you know, Illinois is just one state. You know, California alone in one county, the SEIU gets $50 million per year in one county in L.A. County. It's an insane amount of money. And they didn't immediately recognize Harris versus Quinn. You know, they just kept pulling those dues. So, you know, a lot of cases it's going to take, you know, this separate legal challenges in each state to have that recognized. Now, our lawsuit is very similar to the Harris versus Quinn case. It's a First Amendment challenge, and we challenged the fees as well, but we took it a step further, and we also challenged the exclusive representation. So when this type of unionization is passed through the legislator or a governor writes an executive order, he's basically creating a bargaining unit out of private businesses. He's grouping and collectivizing private businesses and creating a bargaining unit and then giving the SEIU or in our case it's actually AFSCME, which is the Government Employees Union, exclusive representation of that bargaining unit. So everybody in that unit, whether they are a member or not, whether they want to affiliate with the union or not, they are exclusively represented by that union, and anything negotiated into that contract, you know, they are subject to any of that mandatory training or anything else that the union can negotiate. So we allege that is a violation in itself of our First Amendment rights, that the government choosing for citizens who will represent them in their petitioning the government is a violation. We're allowed free association under the First Amendment, and this type of unionization denies us that. Now, in our particular bill, the lawmakers created this bargaining unit, and they allowed for an election to happen. In order for the election to happen, the union has to collect 30% of the signatures of the eligible voters and then petition for an election. They haven't done that yet. Our case was we won an injunction last October pending the Harris case, and then once the Harris case was released, the opinion was released in that, the injunction was lifted. So right now we're on a holding pattern. We can't bring our lawsuit back until the union petitions for an election, so we're waiting for them to make their next move before we move forward.
Yeah, now, I was watching the video that the National Right to Work put out at the time the decision came out, and it was extremely interesting. The states like California and Vermont and others that have been taking out all these union dues, people are automatically assuming once the Supreme Court issued the ruling on Harris versus Quinn, they would get their money back. But that's not the case.
No, it's not.
The court said nothing whatsoever about returning the money that they was taken away from these people unconstitutionally. So that means that now each and every one of them has to enter into a class action suit state by state in order to force the state to return the money, right?
Exactly, and that's already started. The day after the Harris versus Quinn ruling on June 30th, the day after that, another case brought by National Right to Work as well out of Michigan, Schlag versus Snyder, I believe it is, was a group of child care providers who had tried to file a class action lawsuit. The union there had been dissolved when they got a new governor, but the union had taken over $4 million, I believe, in dues from them already. So they were had already previously filed a class action lawsuit, and their class action status was denied. They petitioned to the Supreme Court as well. And the Supreme Court, the day after the Harris ruling, sent that overturned that and sent that back down to the lower court for them to reconsider taking the Harris case into consideration. So it looks very promising that there's a good chance they're going to be able to get their dues back. But again, that will only cover Michigan, like you said. Every single state is going to have to bring a class action lawsuit if they hope to get their dues returned.
Yeah, absolutely. Excuse me, there goes my voice again. Oh, I'm going to have one of these up and down up and down days today. You know, one of the things I saw on your Twitter page, which had me cracking up, you describe yourself as a child care provider, small business owner, leader of coalition of union-free providers, lover of cupcakes, wine, shoes, and freedom. I
with
love
an
it.
Emphasis Happy- on the wine.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in all of this.
Well, it's actually pretty funny. You know, I've been fighting this now for 8.5 years, and prior to this, I was not involved in politics at all. I hated politics. I barely made it to the polls to vote. I did it, but I didn't really do a whole lot of research ahead of time, and I've always been conservative-leaning, but, I've never felt an impact. You know, of course you feel little ones, but not a big impact that really compelled me to do something involving government. So I had a really nasty experience with a union organizer, caring for children, running my business. My husband was gone. You know, all the neighbors on our block were gone. So it was just me on this block. And I had a union organizer walk into my home without knocking. And he was very persistent, argued with me, wouldn't leave, and it was a really intimidating experience. And the whole time that he was there, he never mentioned the word union. He was asking me to sign up what he said was a petition asking the state for health insurance for child care providers. I already had health insurance. I didn't feel comfortable signing anything, especially with the tactics that he was using. And so I was trying to get him to leave. The way that I finally got him to leave was I told him that I would sign his petition if he just left it for me to look over when I had time. And I threw it up onto the countertop and didn't even look at it until later that day at nap time. And when the kids went down and when I looked over this petition, that was the first time that I saw the word union. And, this was something I almost signed to get him to leave. And had I signed it, I would have been signing over the rights to exclusively represent my business. I would have been agreeing to pay dues to this union. It would have enrolled me as a member. And I was so furious that this man came into my home and just violated what's supposed to be a safe space. And I was so furious about that it was the first time that I reached out to my representative. And I always joke about this because at the time I didn't even know who my representative was. So I just went to the state website and sent an email, a very upset email to every single lawmaker in the state because I didn't know who mine was. But it was effective. I mean, it raised awareness back then, it was very hard to get people to believe that this was really happening. You know, even the lawmakers that were on our side had a hard time believing that this could happen. Oh, well, that will never happen. That will be ruled unconstitutional. If that happens, you can just take them to court. You know, and we really had a hard time getting them to understand that this was happening to us and that we needed help and we needed something to protect us. And so of course, once Governor Dayton admitted years down the road in 2011 that he was going to do this, then they started to take us seriously, and that's when we got quite a bit of assistance from the Republican lawmakers, and there was even a couple of DFL or Democrat lawmakers that were supportive of us and were opposed to this and voted against it, but not enough to the bill passed by one vote, unfortunately. So that's how I got involved. It's not something that I ever wanted to do. Like I said, I don't like politics, but it's one of those issues where something happens sometimes that makes you take notice of what's around you. And to me, I feel like this is my business. And, you know, anytime that you start a small business, anybody who has ever started a small business before knows what kind of sacrifice and blood, sweat, and tears goes into building a business from the ground up, and to have something like that, and in some ways have politicians trying to take it from me. I don't want to be anybody's employee. I don't want to be the state's employee, and I don't want a union interfering with my ability to run my business, which is a successful business. I don't need their help. I don't need anything that they're offering. So, you know, I think it just took something like that to really wake me up and get me involved. And now, you know, having been involved to this degree, I don't think I'd ever be able to not be involved, you know, even if this issue one day is completely, you know, out of the picture. I think, you know, there's too many issues out there that I've seen, and I'm pretty disgusted with the way that, you know, politicians, seeing firsthand how they trade favors, and it's a pretty disgusting process to watch. So it's something where I'll be involved, you know, even after this is done, but that's how I got involved, and I you know, hope to one day be effective at what I'm doing.
Well, you seem to be very effective.
Yeah. Jennifer, I have a question for you real quick.
Sure.
Obviously, our union friends here, they're not going to go down without a fight. And
No. And
you see what they're trying to do as far as the fast food industry in our country, et cetera. And so they're not going to go down without a fight. And if you go and look at your website, you can see at the different efforts in the different states that this type of movement is taking place in. My question is, have you faced any ramifications from the unions? Because, you know, sometimes unions tend not to fight very fair in battles like this. Have there been any ramifications against your business, against you personally, family, et cetera?
You know, once we filed, back in the 2006 time frame, there was times where they would follow me home from child care trainings and such. They would show up to the same child care trainings, and then they would tail me home. And we had a garage broken into once, which I suspect was probably related, since they didn't take anything, even though there was money there. They just rifled through all the papers. And, you know, so there were things like that. But once we filed our lawsuit, once they realized that we had legal counsel, they really were very cautious around us after that. You know, we've had the executive director of our state association had her tire slashed, which of course we suspect was probably due to that, because she was testifying at the Capitol against this bill when it happened. You know, so there are people like that that are still that still see things and you know, experience unfortunate incidents. But for the most part, they have not done anything like that. Now, back in 2013, when this bill was going through the legislature, at the exact same time that it was going through the legislature, the same union-friendly politicians that were pushing it through also pushed through some ridiculous and over-the-top regulations against child care providers, and we suspect that was partially also in part to make us feel like we needed a union, and also in part as retaliation, because we, you know, we're fighting it so hard. So we think that, you know, we feel like there has been some retaliation against our businesses in that aspect, but no violence or anything like that yet. So hopefully it doesn't escalate to that, but I wouldn't put it past them. We've seen what they're capable of, and we've read the stories online. So it's a concern. And, you know, here in Minnesota, there's enough child care providers who are opposed to this, so that there's a very big group of us that is standing together to oppose this. But there's other states where, you know, I know in Michigan they had a really hard time, because it's the land of the UAW that was before Right to Work, and it was actually the UAW that partnered with the union to bring or to unionize these child care providers. And I know that it was a very intimidating experience for them to, you know, to have to file a lawsuit. And, you know, so I don't think that there was ever any violence or anything like that. But, you know, they tried as best as they could to intimidate without crossing that line. And, you know, the intimidation is a big thing. That's, you know, when our bill was being passed, there was a couple of days where there was protests. And we had, they flew protesters from out of state. There was no, I mean, at any given time, there was fewer than six pro-union child care and home care providers there at all, pretty much at all times. It was all, but they stacked the Capitol with people who were not child care providers, home care providers, state employees who said that they were getting paid union leave time to be there to protest. But there were some people at those events that were very pushy. They would stand up against our bodies in a way to intimidate us, you know, men who towered over us. So things like that, you know, they definitely do a lot of that still, but it's not, you know, so far no violence. Hopefully it stays that way.
Isn't that the way always of bullies? It's
yeah.
always the,
yeah.
it's, they are just nothing but a bunch of bullies. I've been putting up in the chat room the link to your website, which is childcareunioninfo.com. It's also up on our show page, so if anyone wants to see it, they can always go back to the description of the show page here and click on the link to it. It's extremely informative on there. And on there, you also have a publication written by the National Women's Law Center about getting organized, unionizing home-based child care providers. And reading through this booklet, you know, I kind of speed read through it last night quickly, but some of this stuff is really, really scary.
Oh, but that was written. You have to keep in mind when you're reading that it was written by a pro-union organization that supports unionizing the child care business space. And they also receive funding from the union. So you have to kind of look at it through you know, keeping all that in mind. But yeah, I mean, it's very scary, some of the things that they're doing. And now that the Harris case has ruled out those compulsory fees, they are using those exclusive bargaining rights to try and find alternate ways to get funds. So, for instance, in Washington, they require these parents caring for their own children with disabilities to now take 75 hours of training. You know, one-size-fits-all type training, you know, that the union gets, I mean, tens and tens of millions of dollars for, I imagine, they've gotten through this program. And they tried pushing a similar initiative in California as well against the wishes of the home care providers that they represent, you know, as a way to, you know, again, get millions of dollars from the state as those dues funds are drying up. And the other tactic that they're resorting to is that, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that the fair share fees were unconstitutional, but if you sign a union membership card, you're volunteering to pay dues. So they changed the language on their membership cards so that when you sign it, you are locked into paying dues for at least a year, and then every year you've got like a 10-day opt-out window, I believe, and then if you don't opt out during that 10 days, you're re-enrolled for another year after that. So they're locking people in, they're showing up at their doors, you know, letting them know that they need to update their records and tricking them into signing these cards. And, you know, unbeknownst to the person signing, they're agreeing to pay dues, so the Harris ruling won't apply to them. So, they definitely have a lot of ways to find other ways to get dues through that exclusive representation and at the cost of, you know, child care providers and home care providers.
You know, what's really scary is that, you know, if you're someone in a home taking care for a child or a parent, someone that is disabled or even just rearing your child at home, you're isolated. There's no
right
network for anyone to reach out. So when someone like this appears at your door, you feel helpless. You feel like there's nowhere that you can turn to. Maybe you can turn to your legislator. Maybe they know what's going on. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're in on it. You don't know. And there's no way to know how many people have been affected by this. You know,
right.
With the growing number of autistic kids being born, that means that's going to increase the growing number of home care for these children.
Right.
And
the baby boomers are aging and retiring. I mean, you know, as the co-host said, I mean, they have, you know, it's not just parents with children with disabilities. It's children taking care of their aging and ailing parents as well. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, this industry in itself is, I believe it's been deemed one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing industry that there is. You know, so in fact, the SEIU, I can't remember what the number was, but I believe that they've got over 600,000 or about 20% of their membership was home care and child care providers. I mean, that's a significant chunk of people who aren't even state employees who've been reclassified as such just so that they could fall into this union scheme.
All right. Now, you're listening to Jennifer Parrish, and she's with the Child Care Union Info. Child care, a mother, a small business owner, fantastic lady. Anyone wants to ask her questions, the call-in number is 917-889-3675. And if you do want to ask a question, please remember to press 1 so I know to bring you on that you do have something you want to say. So feel free to give a call in. I see a bunch of people sitting here on the phone line, but no one's pressed the number 1. So unless they do that, I will not be able to bring them on. But I'm telling people that they've got to go to your website. You know, looking at what you have on there, Connecticut, it was passed by executive order and then statute. Illinois, the same. Maryland, Massachusetts, New Mexico, New York, figures. Oregon, figures. Rhode Island, New Jersey, Washington, Iowa, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Folks, if you're in any of these states and you know someone or you are someone that is under this situation, you know, get a hold of Jennifer. Go to a website, click on it. You have on there how people can actually, if you had gotten one of those cards. My mind is going backwards. It's not going forwards today. I call them app scam. If they got one of the union cards, that you have a link on there where they can ask them to have the card returned or they can call and have the card returned. They can go, if they want more information, childcareunioninfo@gmail.com. I mean, this is a fascinating, fascinating stuff. Now, fortunately, or I should say unfortunately, I don't have children, so I've never been in this type of a situation. But I do know a bunch of people that do take care of adult children that are disabled. And we do have someone that just raised their hand. Let me bring this individual in on the air. Area code 817, you're on the air with Southern Sense and our guest, Jennifer Parrish. Who am I speaking to?
This just hurts my feelings. Y'all are picking on a noble union that would want to take care of people so much that they would resort to fraud and deceit. You should respect people like that.
Yeah.
That's the one and only underground professor.
That was sarcasm you heard.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, I picked up on that.
Go ahead, Professor.
You guys are just a bunch of meanies. I don't know what to say. I just find it abhorrent. I mean, literally, it just makes my skin crawl when I think that my government can come in and tell me these kind of things and not think there's anything wrong with it. You know, that to tell me who I have to associate with, where I have to buy, and it's, you know, look, they told us where we have to buy our insurance, and now they're telling us who has to represent us. It's not a big leap. I'm surprised it was ruled unconstitutional.
I'm hoping that it will be ruled unconstitutional. That issue hasn't been addressed by the courts yet. So there's a case out in Massachusetts on behalf of child care providers. And then our case here in Minnesota from child care providers, and also a separate lawsuit here in Minnesota brought out on behalf of home care providers that challenges that exclusive representation. And, you know, I'm pretty confident that once it gets up to the Supreme Court that they're going to rule that this scheme is unconstitutional and SEIU is going to have to look elsewhere to siphon dues from, you know, other than mothers caring for their disabled children and women-owned businesses is what they're going after. So, but I'm fairly confident that, you know, I've read, you know, enough of the Constitution to know that my interpretation of it is that this is very unconstitutional. There's not even a question. It's just a matter of getting to the Supreme Court so that it can be ruled that way.
You notice you had successes with your legislature, and then they lost the elections. And I'm sure there's no coincidence that SEIU also has the contract to repair all the electronic voting machines. So I wouldn't be worried about it.
It was the only way Obama could win 2 terms. Didn't you know that, Professor? Let's not get into that, folks.
You can mute me. I'll let you guys get back to it.
All right.
There's going to be a lot of background noise on my end, so I don't want to cover it all up.
All right. Underground Professor, he has a radio show that also airs through Pundit Press, because Dan, my co-host, is the proprietor of Pundit Press, which we also broadcast on. So actually you're in 7 markets right now across the nation.
Perfect.
Oh, great.
Wonderful.
All right. Kayla, I know that you're sitting back there with a couple of questions. Go ahead, girl.
I do, and it's an honor to speak with you. It's a wonderful opportunity to listen to you and speak about these issues. I have always been rather anti-union myself, Jennifer. I hail from Canada, and one issue that I'm noticing in particular is the teachers' unions in Ontario. And they are controlling the vote here, and we cannot, for the life of us, get rid of the Liberals. And the unions become so politically powerful. Is there not any way that there could be legislation to ensure that they stay out of the political arena?
You know, that's a tricky one because, you know, it's double-sided. You know, if we tell the unions that they cannot, because of the type of a nonprofit they are, that they cannot be involved in politics, then on the other side, all the other organizations for the conservatives would not be able to be involved in politics as well. And, you know, it sounds to me like the Supreme Court, for the most part, with Citizens United, ruled that it was a violation of the First Amendment to try and, you know, rein in that type of speech by political organizations. So, and I could be wrong about that, but I don't know that, you know, I'm a big free speech person. I think that people have the right to speak freely and petition government. The problem that I have with unions is that they use money that is that people are compelled to give them. They rely on compulsion to survive. And so they're taking money from people who don't oftentimes agree with what they're doing, and they're using that money for politics. And, you know, the unions are supposed to report how much money they spend on politics and how much money they spend on representation. But if you go through their reports, you see that, you know, they claim a certain amount as politics, but the stuff that they're claiming is representation, you know, a large percentage of it is political. I mean, they're giving money to these, you know, far left-wing groups. They're you know, spending money on literature that is politically motivated. You know, most of what they do, unions in general, is political, and with public sector unions, the argument in our lawsuit is that everything they do is inherently political because they are literally petitioning the government for everything that they want. So since the government is the employee, the state government is the employee, in order for them to get a raise or a pension, they have to petition the government, and that in itself is political. So, you know, that's a tough one to answer.
Go ahead, Kayla.
I just want to round out my a question comment in saying that I have a real issue with the lobby groups that they also create.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice if it just went back to regular old citizens, wouldn't it? I don't know if that's going to happen. But, you know, there definitely needs to be, I think, a lot more oversight on what people are spending politically and what they're, you know, I'm not saying that necessarily that there needs to be a limit, but there needs to be at least some more oversight and transparency, especially when it comes to government unions.
Right on.
Jennifer, I want to bring this out real quick. A lot of people don't know that there are lots of great alternatives out there to unions as far as associations and other organizations. And in this particular case, you know, there's a national, you have the National Association for Family Child Care. In Minnesota, you have the Family Child Care Association. So why don't you kind of talk about the pros and cons of associations being able to help private child care providers?
Sure. Well, associations are very different than unions. Associations are 100% voluntary, so you can choose to belong to it, you can choose not to belong to it. Since they are 100% voluntary, they have to provide a service to their members, otherwise they won't have members. So typically there's a lot more of a benefit to an association than there is a union. Here in my city here, we've got a local county child care association. Membership fees for that are $40 per year. which is what some child care providers are paying per month for union dues. And through that association, I get all the training that I need. I get networking. I get a free classified section where I can post any openings that I've got. There's a public policy committee with our association. So, any legislative issues that need to be addressed, we have a say in all of that already. We've already got a seat at the table, if you will. All for $40 a year. So, now with unions, they rely on compulsion, as I said. So they don't have to work for their members. All they have to do is get somebody to sign that bill or write an executive order saying, yep, this organization is going to represent you, whether you like it or not, and they can take fees from you. And, of course, in that case, the state serves as the bill collector. Our association, they've got to collect their membership dues and fees themselves. The state, in this case, if you sign one of those membership cards, whether you knew what you were signing or not, the state's going to take that money out of any child care assistance checks that you get on behalf of low-income families, and they're going to send it directly to the union for you, so you don't even get an option. You can't stop payment on those dues. So a lot of these states that have unionized child care providers, there's really very little benefit. In fact, many see no benefit whatsoever. This union focuses on the assistance program, the child care assistance program, since that's what this unionization scheme is surrounded around, is those government dollars. So if a family is low income, they can go to the county or the state, and they can ask for assistance. And there's, food stamps, and there's Medicaid, and there is, child care assistance and rental assistance. And so those families that qualify for that child care assistance, they qualify for a certain amount. They're responsible to pay the rest of the child care bill, and then they get to use those dollars wherever they see fit. They can even have grandma watch the kids and get paid, and they can use it at a licensed family child care home like mine, or a center, or wherever they choose, they can use those dollars. And that money there is not my benefit, and the child care assistance rates are not my rates. My rates are set by me, and they are higher than the child care assistance rates. So the union is trying to fuzzy the picture a little bit and claim that the low child care assistance rates are actually my salary and I'm working for $2 an hour. I assure you I'm not that big of a fool. I wouldn't work for $2 an hour, even if I, regardless of how much I love my job. They publicly are saying that, oh, these poor providers, they're making $2 an hour. They're barely scraping by. And we're going to go in and we're going to, negotiate with the state a higher assistance rate. Well, that helps the families out a lot. That doesn't help me out a lot because, if they raise it to, if my rates are, $200 a week and assistance pays for $150, the family is responsible for that $50 that remains, and I get my $200 a week regardless. If the state raises those child care assistance rates to $200, I'm still getting my $200. The parent doesn't have to pay a copay anymore, so it's great for those low-income families. But now I get dues taken out of that. So the benefit that they're claiming to provide is not even truly a benefit to child care providers.
Yeah, they're trying to claim that these individuals are state employees, but they don't get a pension, they don't get health care benefits, they don't get vacation, they don't get overtime, and this is a 24-hour care. They don't get, an hour off for lunch. So they have no benefits of an employee, so it's impossible to lay them as an employee.
Right. But that didn't stop them now, did it? We always laugh that one of the first governors to push this scheme through was Blago, whatever, Blagojevich, who's sitting in jail right now, prison right now. I mean, because that really is what it takes. It takes somebody who is fairly corrupt that, it's not that these governors did not realize what they were doing was wrong. They knew what they were doing was wrong, but the people that they were trying to pay back were these unions that helped them get elected and continue to do favors for them while they're in office. And I scratch your back, you scratch mine. And, unfortunately that comes at the cost of these, parents caring for their children with disabilities and these businesses, which are predominantly owned by women, by the way. So if you want to talk about war on women, you know, to take these groups of businesses owned by women who, that should be celebrated, these small business owners who are making a living for themselves, and instead they're, you know, telling us that we're not capable of running a successful business without the help of this male-dominated women. So there's your war on women right there.
That is true. Now, I'm just curious, how the heck does the union know which doors to knock on? Are they filing a FOIA and asking for names and addresses of individuals that apply for help?
In some cases, I mean, in some cases it's that, and in some cases they don't even need to necessarily file a FOIA. They just go and ask for it, and they're given it. So, you know, they get the list from the government in every single case. You know, which in itself to me is a privacy issue, especially, you know, with childcare businesses here in Minnesota anyway, and I think it's this way in most states. We are a business. We have, you know, we're registered with the state as a business. Our information is public. So they can get our information on that website. However, the parents caring for children with disabilities, that information, I don't believe should be public. I don't think that they should be able to me, I feel like that is a safety concern, to allow these union organizers to be coming to the homes with families who are, you know, very, very tied up caring for some of these folks with disabilities. And they're not employees at all. They're not anyone's, you know, they're unlike us. They don't run a business. They're not, they're merely, you know, caring for their own kids, and that information should not be given to a union in my opinion, but it is, unfortunately, and this is what we end up with, you know, after that's done. And you know, when they come to your home, a lot of times, in my case, they don't even tell you who they are. You know, they're not honest about who they are. Most cases, they're not wearing identification. And, you know, I've never met anybody to this day, and I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of care providers across this country. I've never met one person, aside from the union-paid ones who claim that they were, who were told what they were signing. You know, they're told that it's a petition. They're told that it's to sign up for more information. They're told that it's to update their records. They are never told that they are signing a union authorization card or enrolling in the union. So, and then, of course, the union gets the signature, the organizer gets the signature on the card, and they take it with them. They're not left with anything afterwards to see what they signed, so they don't even realize after the fact that that's what they signed. So, you know, that's how they've been so successful. You know, they're able to trick people into it, and they show up when they're unexpected and trick people into signing them, and then they're stuck.
Hey, so now, Jennifer, why don't you elaborate a little bit further about what people, because we know that the unions are not going to give up this fight, and they're going to keep pressing and pressing. Why don't you elaborate a little further about, you know, what rights these folks need to know, some safety tips, and how to be prepared if a union organizer shows up on their doorstep?
Sure. You know, and the biggest thing is just expecting it, you know. So be aware, if you care for a child or if you're, you know, caring for a loved one in any way with a disability and you are part of that government program, that Medicaid program, and get funding for that, you know, if you have not received a knock at your door yet, if you're not one of the states that's already unionized, be prepared because they are coming for you eventually. So if somebody ever shows up at your door, be prepared. Ask questions. Never sign anything. You know, we go to the bank and we apply for a loan or sign any other financial documents, and they're required to go through the list with us of what all we're signing, and we get copies of it afterwards. Never sign anything unless you're going to get a copy of it afterwards. So that's, you know, good practice to begin with. For the states that do have these unions in place already, you know, you do have rights as well. You know, this Harris ruling, whether the unions want to admit it or not, does apply to you. And if there isn't already a lawsuit brought in your state, I cannot emphasize enough that you need to reach out to the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I mean, they are just, you know, such an amazing organization. It costs you nothing. You know, nothing at all. They pay all the court costs. They pay all the filing fees. They pay for local legal counsel if it's needed. They cover all the costs. And they take a case knowing that, you know, the idea of when they take a case, the idea is to get it up to the Supreme Court. So they're not going to take it fulfill that first step in district court and then expect you to, you know, and say, oh, we don't got the money to move it forward. No, they are going to take your case if they take it, and they're going to take it all the way up to the Supreme Court if they can. So, you know, all of that's covered, and they answer all of your questions. So reach out to them. Even if you've got questions, even if you're not interested in filing a lawsuit, just reach out to them and ask your questions. They're so patient. And that was one of our biggest assets in the beginning was, you know, when we first put our website up, the union told us that it was slander and threatened to sue us over it. And, you know, your initial thought when you're threatened with a lawsuit from this organization that's worth millions and millions of dollars is to retreat. And that's the intent, you know, on their part. They knew that they wouldn't have a case, but they also knew that we didn't have the funding to fight them in court. So, you know, contacting the National Right to Work organization, they gave us free legal advice telling us that we were well within our rights and that if the union tried to sue us, that they would represent us in that case and that we were good to go. So we were able to keep that website up. And for that free legal counsel, if you've got any questions, go ahead and give them a call. You don't have to pay fair share fees, you know, even if there hasn't been a lawsuit brought in your state. So contacting them or contacting us through our website, we can let you know how to you know, file a claim with the union to have those dues at least stopped for now. And then hopefully down the road you can benefit from a class action lawsuit brought in your state. So, and then in terms of when door knockers come to your door, you know, that is the area that really people don't understand. You know, you have rights through that process. They are not entitled to come into your home. You have every right to tell them to leave and tell them to never come back. If you hang a sign on your door telling them that there's no union organizing on the premises and that you will report them to the authorities if they knock on your door, they can't knock on your door. And if they do, you can charge them with trespassing. So, you know, just getting educated, go through our website and see what your rights are. We actually have a tab up there. I'm not sure what it's called exactly, but, you know, your rights through the process or the door knocking process or something along those lines. And it goes through what your rights are. You have every right not to sign a card. They can't withhold your payments at all. They can't, you know, you won't lose your benefits if you refuse to sign. So, just be very aware, you know, I would never sign anything to begin with, you know, with anybody coming to my door, because if somebody has something of service or something that I am going to want, they're not going to need to come to my door for me to get it. I'm going to go out and look for it. So just be very cautious. And you have the right to call the police if you feel like you are intimidated. And that's where I made my mistake. I did not call the police and I did not file a police report. And hindsight is always 20/20. But if somebody ever comes to your home and makes you feel uncomfortable or, you know, is dishonest with you, you have every right to call the police and definitely do that and file a police report. So, yeah, I mean, everybody's got rights through this process. The union tries to tell you that you don't. You know, they try and tell you that it's illegal to speak out against them, and it's not. You can speak out against them as much as you want. They cannot charge you with unfair labor practices for being opposed to unionization. You have that right. So, you know, and exercise your rights. They're yours. Exercise them, you know, speak out against them. Don't be intimidated by them, because that's how they win.
Well, Jennifer, you said something very, very important, and I want to bring that point forward. Having been a retired police officer, that was one of the first things I would have advised you to do. File a police report trespassed. First off, you said they never even knocked on the door, and they entered. And then they accosted you. So that raises it from just a simple trespass to actually now in the state of New York would be called a burglary. That would be called robbery. Because they're attempting to extract something from you by force. They've entered your home, that's trespass.
Yeah.
The next step, once they commit a crime in your home, that advances to burglary. Once you approach them and you try to get them out or whatever, now it's advanced to robbery. And that's very important. If we start putting some of these people behind bars, and the problem is mainstream media is not picking this up. This is happening in all 50 states. Vita was asking if it's something we should be concerned about in all 50 states. And yes, we should.
Oh, yeah. Yep, absolutely.
I mean, even if you live in a right-to-work state like I'm in South Carolina, it doesn't mean that they won't attempt to do this here.
Exactly. And especially most right-to-work states, if I understand this correctly, pretty much pertain to the dues only. You know, they can still get this exclusive representation of these bargaining units, and once they have that, they can negotiate all sorts of things into a contract to make your life miserable and to try and twist your arm into voluntarily paying dues. So, you know, even in right-to-work states, you know, you're absolutely right. It's a big concern.
Yeah, Kel, I know you're sitting back there with another question because I see you typing up in the chat room. I want to welcome everyone that is in the chat room and listening in on the phone lines. Phone lines to call to ask Jennifer questions is 917-889-3675. And please remember to press 1 if you have a question you want to ask. Go ahead, Kel.
Thanks, Annie. Jennifer, just a little while back you brought up the issue that they would show up at your door and they were not identifying themselves via badges or anything like that. I was wondering, they're obviously violating something in doing this, but they seem to stay just an inch within the law in doing this. But this is intimidation. And is there no recourse that people can take? Is there no legal recourse that people can take against these individuals and these organizations for that?
You know, and that has been one of our biggest frustrations through this process is that, you know, we learned very quickly that unions get to play by a different set of rules than everyone else. They, you know, for instance, when I talked to after my experience, and it was, you know, probably 6 to 8 months after my experience, I talked to a police officer, and I asked him, you know, what can I do about this? Because at that point I was just furious and I saw that they weren't backing down. And he said, you know, really, you know, there's really not a whole lot the police could do. They could come and they could tell him to leave. And, you know, I mean, you know, they weren't willing to take it to that step of filing charges against him. And you know, if he comes back, just give us a call and we can, you know, well, at that point the damage is already done. And then he encouraged me to call our state labor board because unions are the oversight of unions is through the state and federal labor boards. So I did. I called our state labor board and I was told that they couldn't even take my complaint because I wasn't unionized yet. So I did not fall under their jurisdiction. Then I called the national labor board and got the same answer. So no one would even not only do anything about my complaint, but they wouldn't even take it. So, and then after this bill was passed, we asked our state labor board that was overseeing this election to come, ask them, you know, what kind of recourse do child care providers have when these union organizers are showing up to their door and not being honest with them and making them feel intimidated? Well, if they break a law like, you know, assault or, you know, harassment or whatever, you know, then you can call the police. But really, we were told anyway that there really aren't a whole lot of laws or guidelines for them to have to follow during the organizing process. You know, there's a lot of unfair labor practice, things that unions can file against, you know, companies, but not a whole lot to protect the employees, unfortunately. So we are in desperate need of labor reform in this country.
I'm just concerned about the intimidation factor. Like, what would it take for this to be legally cracked down upon? Would you have to have a second party with you tape recording this? So you don't even know when they're going to show up at your door or walk through your door.
Yep, it's all unannounced. You know, and typically, you know, we're fortunate here in Minnesota because we know that they're coming. You know, we know that this bill has been passed and they have the intent to do this, to get these signatures. In most states, they were very good about going about this organizing process, and they would fly organizers in, they'd hit the ground running and collect a bunch of signatures without really letting the providers know that it was even taking place. And then they'd take it to a governor and, you know, he'd sign an executive order and it was a done deal. You know, there's, you know, a lot of states where there wasn't even an election, a union election. They would just take these cards that were signed under false pretenses and accept them as though they were ballots. So, and of course it was a union paid for American Arbitration Association guy counting these ballots under union watch. So it wasn't even a fair card check, if you will. But there's, you know, in order for this to change, like I said, we have to have sweeping labor reform in this country. And you know, really there's not a call for it yet. People don't realize how you know, how much of this is happening and what they're allowed to get away with. You know, when we hear about unfair labor practices, again, it's typically a union or an employee filing an unfair labor practice claim against a company or an employer. It's usually not the other way around that you hear, but it happens. But then again, what's going to happen when you file a complaint at the National Labor Board that is stacked with Obama appointees that are, you know, used to work for unions? And you know, I was just looking at one of the divisions of the oversight. There's a federal oversight committee or you know, webpage, the Office of Labor Management Services or something along those lines, that handles all the union reporting. And I was going through some union reports the other day, and one of them just received a check from the union last year. So it's not, you know, I mean, these are not typically people who are independent-minded. These are people who already favor, you know, unionization. And in some cases where they used to be union employees, they participated in these types of, you know, unfair and unjust practices themselves. So, you know, they're not going to rule against themselves or the unions that help them get where they are. And, you know, so we definitely need labor reform in this country. I believe it's Orrin Hatch has a bill called the Employee Rights Act. And if you go to unionfacts.com, you can see it right there on their front page typically. And that is a great start. It would require the unions to get to recertify every 2 years. So a union wouldn't be able to just get in and stay in forever. You know, every 2 years they'd have to go through an election again. And I think that we're getting to the point where a lot of these government unions and, you know, unions like what we have here, child care and home care unions that aren't even technically government employees, given the chance to vote again, they would vote no. And I think that's what it's going to take is to get the money out of the unions. You know, as long as that money's flowing to them, they're going to keep giving that money to the lawmakers that are going to in turn write favorable laws for them and you know, stop reform. So, you know, that would be a great place to start. There's also some other things in there about, you know, that card check practice where they, in lieu of a vote, they just get those signatures on the cards and count that as good. That would be, that would not happen under this law. So there's a lot of good provisions in there. So that would be a great place to start. There's a lot more that needs to happen, but really at this point I think people need to ask for it. So call your lawmakers, call your both at a state and national level, you know, and ask them to do some reform. I mean, it's time that unions start having to play by the rules that everyone else plays by.
Yeah, you know, what really angers me about your story is that when you had finally talked to a police officer and he told you there really wasn't anything that could be done, that's not true. You still could have filed a complaint against that individual, still could have had it on file for his criminally trespassing onto your property. And I don't understand why any police officer would tell you otherwise. They're there to serve and protect you.
Yeah.
Not to collect a paycheck just for the sake of collecting a paycheck. You know, you become a police officer because you feel that you need to serve the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry that happened to you, because that is not something that would have happened had I shown up on the scene. And if that person ended up showing up at my house, they may have walked in on 2 feet, but they were going to be carried out with 4 feet.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, of course, they know that they're walking into homes where guns are not easily accessible because we're child care providers. So it's not like I could have, you know, even if, you know, I did have a rifle or a shotgun. I can't even remember what it is. I'm not good at that stuff. It was my husband's. But you know, it was locked, you know, in a separate room and in a case that was locked and it had the trigger lock on it. So it wasn't easily accessible anyway. And not that I would have hauled it out necessarily with all the kids there anyway. I mean, that, you know, he didn't, he wasn't outright threatening me. You know, he was very careful about that, but he was getting very angry with me and shaking his head. And I just don't understand why he won't sign this. And, you know, so, I mean, it was, you know, they're very careful to not overtly break the law. And that was kind of what the police officer was asking. Well, did he, you know, did he hurt you? Did he touch you? Did he, you know, and no, he didn't do any of those things, but he wouldn't leave. And he, you know, just kept on harassing me. And, you know, did you threaten to call the police? No, you know, it didn't even occur to me. I was at that point just trying to get him out of my house. While this was happening, I had lunch boiling over on the stove in the other room. I could hear it boiling over. So I was just doing everything in my power to get him out of the house. And like I said, hindsight is 20/20. And hopefully, if nothing else, people will hear my experience and the experience of all these other home care and child care providers, and at least they'll be aware so that when somebody does this to them, they'll ask questions and they'll make that phone call to police and not hesitate. That's what we want them to do.
Yeah, and the worst part is you had children around and you're trying to stay calm so you don't upset them.
Exactly.
You're trying to
protect
them at the same time. And he did that deliberately knowing that you were going to be at a distinct disadvantage.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the things that we asked them. I did a Q&A with one of the union organizers, and we asked them, because they always seem to show up. All these child care providers that I talked to, they always seem to show up right around lunchtime, which is the busiest time of day. I mean, you're trying to feed, you know, picture, you know, for those of you that do have kids, what it's like at dinner time trying to get dinner for two hungry kids. I mean, it's a disaster. I mean, there's tears, they're starting to get tired and cranky, and now multiply that times, you know, six or whatever. I mean, some child care providers can have up to 12 children in their care, you know, in Minnesota, depending on the license that they have. I had about a half dozen at that point in time, and that, you know, that was a lot. I was, you know, very busy, and they knew that. They showed up intentionally, you know, hoping that I wouldn't question them. And, you know, and the other time that they picked up, or they tended to show up at providers' homes was in between 4:30 and 5:30, which is typically when parents are coming to pick up their children, because if we're busy, distracted, talking to the parents about their child's day, we're less likely to ask questions about this petition. So those are the two times that they focused on. And we asked them, well, why don't you come during the evenings or weekends when we are not caring for children? If you insist on doing this, why do you have to come during the day? That's our policy. That was what we were told by the union themselves. It was their policy to come during the day when we were busy. So
policy, we have you completely at a disadvantage. It's, again, I'm going to call them what they are, bullies.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know, Jennifer has, she's been an absolute amazing guest today. Because she's given us some great info on dealing with unions in general, and there's an underlying theme here. You know, at one time in our country, you know, unions served a purpose, but their time has passed. And now what you see the teachers' unions in particular tend to be some of the most vile unions out there. And you're hearing from Jennifer some of the tactics, the underhanded tactics that they use. And people really need to understand, and the underlying theme here, and Jennifer can elaborate on this more, that unions, they're not out there to benefit the workers anymore. They're not out there to serve the workers, their members anymore. The unions are out there to serve themselves.
Right. They're out there to serve themselves, and because they are, you know, probably some of the most far-left political organizations out there. They are an extension of the Democratic Party. And, you know, so they are out there for political purposes. And if you look at the salaries of some of these, you know, union bosses and employees, I mean, it is insane. I mean, we're talking $500,000 a year. The president of the teachers union, the National Teachers Union, Randy Weingartner, I think her name is, or something like that, you know, $500,000 a year. That's insane. All while she's talking about how, you know, railing on the 1%. She's part of it. She's a big part of it. I mean, she's one of the most wealthy people in that entire union, and she's making her money off the backs of these teachers who are paid far less than she is. And you know, on top of that, a lot of these union employees get union cars to use and union housing. The union pays for their condos, you know, union cell phones, union laptops. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, really their salary is only a small, or not in some cases small, but it is only a portion of what kind of benefits that they're receiving. You know, they eat out all the time. They are constantly grabbing lunch out places, and, you know, it's all on the union workers' back. And, you know, you're right. You know, there was a time when there was some pretty awful working conditions in this country. And, you know, back then, it was the employees that were joining together and saying, let's form this union and, you know, let's join together to be stronger. And that was what a union was back then. Nowadays, the union is out actively trying to force people into their ranks to keep power and money flowing. And it's just a completely different picture from what unions used to be. And this type of organization, there's just no place for it in this country. You know, if they have a service that they can offer that will benefit workers, workers will choose to join. They don't need to rely on compulsion to survive.
Yeah, when the unions originally formed, you know, it was more towards, you know, protecting the worker, but now it's to protect themselves.
Exactly, exactly. And they will go to extreme lengths to make sure that that money, you know, continues flowing. And, you know, they often don't tell their employees. Most union workers who are paying dues have no idea how to even get a hold of their union reports so they can see how their union is spending their money. And the ones that do, you know, there's so little oversight that the unions are misclaiming money left and right and claiming political expenditures as representation. And you know, the Harris versus Quinn case out of Illinois, that particular union, it was a union of both home care and child care providers, and there was a few nursing homes thrown in there as well. But it was predominantly home care and child care providers. And that particular union, it was a local. This wasn't a national affiliate. This was a local union. Spent over $1 million in 2013 on travel. Travel. And claimed it as representation. Tell me why a union needs to travel over $1 million worth to effectively represent their home care and child care providers in Illinois. They don't need to. They attended the presidential inauguration on the backs of those workers. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in catering and restaurant bills. And it's insane the way that they waste the members' money. And they are definitely living well off of the backs of the workers.
Yeah, it's amazing. No one's investigating the unions. They're getting away with bloody murder. And yet, if you happen to be a corporate American, if you happen to be a true capitalist, oh, those evil salaries you get when you sit on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And the hypocrisy that we see is absolutely astounding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. And you know, you call them on it and they get vicious. But don't stop calling them on it.
No, and where's mainstream media? Silent.
Yeah.
You hear just crickets.
Exactly.
If it wasn't for the fact I was doing research for a different show that I came across, you know, your name and the lawsuit – you know, I don't think a lot of people today would have ever found out about this.
Nope. And the media in most states covers it like the union wants them to cover it. Oh, these are low-paid workers. They want to unionize. No, it's not us. We're not trying to unionize. We're being unionized. There's a big difference. It's not like we are, you know, trying to organize our own profession. This is being done to us against our will.
Yeah, and then you have the poor person that's struggling to take care of their disabled child or trying to raise the child, you know, in the home or taking care of a parent, and you're struggling month to month to make ends meet, and in comes the union and says, you must give us your money.
Yeah.
And they're already fighting just to survive. And the way they – and it actually steals care from the children, from the adults, whoever
it
is you care from. It steals care from them.
And those home care providers out in California that I told you about where the union is taking in that one county alone $50 million a year from them, they're barely making minimum wage. So as they were out protesting for $15 fast food wages, you know, keep in mind that those are the same people that are taking, you know, $50 million a year from dues, from people who are barely making minimum wage. That's how much they think about a livable wage.
All right, well, we got to take a one-minute break so I can try to get paid for the show. We'll be back in 1 minute. While we take a very short break, let me tell you about our sponsor, Audible. Audible are books that you can download online, and you can sit back and don't have to read. You can hear it play in the background. I checked out the free trial, and the free trial you can check out is at audibletrial.com/Southern Sense. And the book I chose to download by free trial was The Federalist Papers. And I can't wait, because when I sit in my office and I'm working, I like something playing in the background. Normally it's, you know, listening to some other talk show or listening to some music. But this way, I can be enriched and have something. I don't have time to sit down and read hour after hour. I got over 9 hours of recording of over $30 value of the Federalist Papers as a free sample. Just trying out audibletrial.com/Southern Sense. Check them out. You'll be pleased. All right, we're back here on Southern Sense. Our guest is Jennifer Parrish. She's with childcareunioninfo.com. And our call-in number, if you do want to call in and ask her a question, is 917-889-3675. You hear that, Vito? 917-889-3675. I want to give a quick shout-out to those listening in on the phone, and we have Sweet Sue from New Mexico listening in. So, Sue, if you want to ask a question, please remember to press 1 so we can bring you on. Jennifer, this is absolutely fascinating. You know, where do we go from here now?
You know, right now we are, you know, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation is focusing on bringing those cases on behalf of home care and child care providers across the country. And for the most part, we're waiting for another case to get to the United States Supreme Court challenging the exclusive representation of home care or child care providers, because until that happens, until we can have that, you know, deemed unconstitutional, they're going to continue to try and expand on this.
Right. And now your website, I just had it here, childcareunioninfo.com. If someone is not from Minnesota, can they go into your site and get information about their state?
Oh, absolutely. On the right-hand side of the website, we've got a drop-down menu of all the states that have unionized or are under the threat of unionization. So, you know, of course, all of them are under the threat to a certain degree, but those are the ones with active campaigns.
And they can just click on that and get information on how they can help with the fight?
Exactly. And if they send us a message letting us know, you know, what state that they're in, you know, if they'd like to join with others in their state, you know, we can put them in touch with anybody else from their state so that they can, you know, form a coalition of their own to try and push back against it.
All right. And now if there is a lawsuit, or if they want to go forward with a lawsuit, it has to be done state by state. It can't be one huge federal lawsuit this time.
It can't, because it's you know, different laws in each state. The union was pushed through, you know, using different means, and each state has their own little spin on it. So each state has to bring their own lawsuits.
Okay. Dan is having problems. Oh, okay. Dan, I do know I heard you for a second that you did want to ask a question. Go ahead. I think we lost Dan. Oh, he may have one of the kids in the office. All right, Kel. Did I lose Kel?
Did we lose Dan?
I don't know.
Well, I am back.
There he is.
I'm back now. I had to self-mute. I'm dealing with a child that's not feeling well. So, but I'm back.
Well, Dan, I do know I cut you off just before you went to ask a question. I apologize.
Well, now I have lost my train of thought on my question, but now I do have another question.
Wonderful.
Jennifer, why don't you, you know, there's a lot of people out there asking today, you know, what can I do? You know, how can I get involved to get the word out dealing with the situation that you're dealing with in Minnesota with the unions trying to unionize the private child care facilities? Or how, you know, and how to get involved in fighting against the unions in general? You know, what's the best way for these folks to go about doing that?
You know, really the best first step is to reach out to your lawmakers and find out where they stand on the issue. And a lot of them, even the ones that are, you know, sympathetic to our concerns and, you know, aren't very fond of the way unions have been able to operate, a lot of them aren't even aware of how bad it is. So, you know, do your best to educate them, because they're the ones that are going to bring forward any bills. You know, contact, you know, talk to people around you, your neighbors, people at church, because like I said, until people start asking for reform, it's not going to happen. And we need people to start asking for reform. So, you know, contact, you know, talk to all your neighbors. If you've got a local, you know, political party that you associate with, you know, bring this topic to them and let them know what's taking place. Let them know what unions are allowed to get away with, and see if they will also start pushing forward and, you know, asking for change. So, you know, that's the best thing that you can do. If you've got extra money, the National Right to Work could always use it because they are, like I said, bringing those cases, and that's getting a case up to the Supreme Court is very expensive. You know, so if you've got extra money and you don't know where to send it, that's a great place to send it. You know, and if you happen to know, you know, if you are a parent who uses child care, talk to your child care provider about this. Let them know that this is happening. And, you know, if they're not already in a unionized state, you know, just let them know, hey, this could happen. You know, just be cautious and, you know, be wary of anybody that comes to your door and, you know, ask questions and don't sign anything. And you know, so that's the best thing to do is spread awareness and you know, join us in asking for reform because that's really what needs to happen. I mean, if the unions are expected to follow the same rules as everybody else, they're going to start dropping in numbers so quickly, and they're going to be forced to reevaluate how they treat people and you know, the practices that they follow through with. And hopefully one day, you know, that one of the cases that the Harris case, one of the things that they asked for was that the Supreme Court overturn a decision from the late 1970s, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which is the case that kind of allowed for public sector union fees, fair share fees to begin with. And the courts have kind of indicated that they're about ready to hopefully overturn that ruling, which would make essentially the entire public sector unions, all of them, would be, in a sense, right to work. They wouldn't be able to compel anybody to pay fees. So, you know, supporting those cases as they're moving forward, hopefully we can get some reform from the Supreme Court as well.
Oh, yeah. I did forget to mention that case, Abood versus the State Board of Ed, and that was a pivotal point, and that's what they're using to knock on everyone's door. Now, one thing that really bothers me, we have the Medical Privacy Act that was passed under Bush, where any of our medical records cannot be released to anyone else without our express permission. So when you're applying for the Medicaid and for all these other programs to help with the child care and with disabled persons care, wouldn't you have to be filling out medical information to prove that you're eligible for that? So therefore, they're getting your names would fall underneath that Medical Privacy Act?
Right, and the way that they're skirting that is that the person who's filling out the medical records is the person with the disability. They're not getting their information. They're getting the information of the person caring for that person. So even though, you know, they're essentially getting that person's information because they're you know, living with this person a lot of times, so they're getting their address. You know, they're technically not supposed to have access to that information. Whether or not they're getting it, I suspect that they are, at least in some cases. Some of the home care providers that we talked to had an organizer come to their home and specifically name the child that they care for by first name. You know, you must be so-and-so's mom. And that's information that's supposed to be protected under the HIPAA law. So, you know, they're not supposed to get it. Are they getting it? Probably. Unfortunately, but again, the same people who are holding that information are oftentimes the ones that were put into office by these unions. So, you know, it's unfortunately the deck is stacked against us.
Yeah, and DeVito Esposito mentions the Obamacare that even also skirts that rule. And how is that affecting you?
Which one? The Obamacare one? You mean the personal mandate?
Yeah.
Which part of it? Personally, me, it's not affecting me just simply because I have we have health insurance through my husband's employer. It's not the personal mandate part of it isn't affecting me because we had insurance, but our costs have gone up significantly as this bill was being debated that year, our costs started rising dramatically, and we have been told to brace ourselves for the insurance premiums this year, that they're going to go up even more dramatically. And my son, who has Asperger's, which is a highly functioning form of autism, he lost his therapist, unfortunately, who no longer accepts our insurance. as part of the ways that they are trying to, you know, keep costs down as much as possible as they're rising dramatically. You know, some of the things that they're doing within the insurance companies is they are limiting the number of, network providers. And our son's therapist is no longer an in-network provider. So, and that is a direct result of the increasing cost from Obamacare. So, so it's definitely impacted me. And that's, you know, when I was saying that, you know, regardless of what happens with this issue, I will always remain involved in politics. That's another one of those issues that it has, you know, had such a, you know, it has hit so close to home. And my mom has lost her insurance as well. So, you know, I mean, it's hit so close to home, and it's been one of those issues that, you know, is very, you know, near and dear to my heart as well.
Yeah, well, one of the things that, because I did read both bills before they were merged together and passed. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah.
But in one of them, they have it where if you are a child care provider, that they're allowed to go into the homes of these individuals.
Yeah.
And inspect the cabinets to see what they're feeding them and look to see what they're teaching them. And if they don't agree with what the parent or the child caregiver is doing, that they can have that remove the child.
You mean with the is that that's with Obamacare?
Right.
Oh,
right.
Okay. No, I haven't seen that.
No.
It doesn't surprise me, but I haven't seen that yet. But
what got me was is that the individuals that will be going to the homes most likely will be one of these union thugs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That wouldn't surprise me at all. And, of course, those of us who are opposed probably are going to get, you know, a lot more scrutiny than those who are for the union. So, it's hard sometimes to see the difference between or, you know, to tell the difference between where government ends and the union begins. You know, they're so intertwined it's really unfortunate the way that things are going, but.
No, and I call it an incestuous relationship, because how can you have a union representing you when you are the union? So you're voting your own pay raise in, you're approving your own work environment. You know, it's not a boss saying, all right, these I will provide for you. It's it is so incestuous.
Yeah.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really, in some ways, I don't think that this was a good thing at all, but in some ways, it was neat to watch, because we saw all this back in the 2005 and 6 time frame when they first came around, and then the unions, of course, went away until we got a union-friendly governor, and then they were back with a vengeance. But when they came back, you know, that was when the whole state here in Minnesota kind of woke up to this issue, and the media covered it, and we actually did get them to write some fairly critical articles, you know, really questioning whether or not this was, you know, a good thing, which is something that other states weren't fortunate enough to have. But it was kind of neat to watch a lot of these child care providers who had never been involved in politics, some of them had never even been to the Capitol prior to this, to see how they reacted when they saw what was happening at their Capitol and saw how these politicians were trading favors behind closed doors. And, you know, the unions and the, you know, one of the founding members of our coalition, one of the first things that she did when she found out about this union issue was she went to a city council meeting or a county commissioner meeting. And she was so disgusted because the union officials came out of the back doors of, you know, this county commissioner building with the county commissioners, and they were shaking hands and patting each other on the back and laughing, and then the union or the county commissioners promptly attempted to unionize these child care providers against their wishes, even though they had a petition saying that 90% of them were opposed. So, you know, that allowing them to see firsthand how things work, I think, is really important. I think, you know, unfortunately, it takes things like this where people are directly impacted that forces them to the Capitol so they can actually keep an eye on their lawmakers and see what's going on. And then once they see what's going on, you've got a whole new, you know, slew of political activists, in a sense, because they're so disgusted by what they see. So that's one good thing that kind of came out of this, is we've got a lot more people aware than we did prior.
All right, we've got a caller in on the line. Let me bring this individual in. Area code 407, you're on the air live with Southern Sense, and our guest, Jennifer Parrish. Who am I speaking to?
Mama Mia, no Sharia.
Vito, Vito. Welcome aboard.
Well, I'll be.
I'll be. I'm at work, but I tell you, I'm incensed over this. And the fact that somebody walked into this lady's house and manhandled her in front of her kids. What union is this? Is this SEIU, AFL-CIO? What union were they forcing you to join?
At that time, it was the SEIU. That organizer was with the SEIU. Now it's AFSCME that is trying to organize us. They originally, when they were first came to Minnesota, they were fighting over us, SEIU and AFSCME. And then they shortly after that realized that that wasn't doing them any good, so they went to arbitration and they divvied us up. And SEIU took the southern half and AFSCME took the northern half of Minnesota. And, you know, now after, you know, after us not, SEIU was never even able to get the majority of cards signed. We were so effective here in the south. So they went away altogether, and now they're organizing the home care providers. But so it's AFSCME now. But it was SEIU that did that. Both of them are awful. Both of them have used horrible tactics. But that particular incident was an SEIU organizer.
Yeah, it's the same thugs that Obama called in when the town hall meetings for his Obama Doesn't Care wasn't going well, and they started strong-arming the individuals into shutting up and suppressing the voices of the freedom of speech. And it's amazing that they walked into your house. I can't believe this. This is America, and you know what? If you would have shot the bastard, it would have been great.
Except I'd have six kids going through therapy right now because they would have witnessed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's you know, I would have been well within my rights, I believe. I, you know, probably would have lost my business in the process, having, you know, discharged a firearm with children in the home. But but yeah, it's a really sick way that they operate. And, you know, SEIU is known for these tactics. It's not something that, you know, they told me at the time, SEIU, that it was just one bad organizer. Oh, it's just, you know, it was just that guy. We're not doing that. Well, you know, those stories were all over the state. You know, it was not just one bad organizer. This is how they're trained. You know, they find people who are willing to, you know, scrape the bottom of the barrel for tactics and skirt the law. And I came across an SEIU training manual back in, I think, you know, like the 2006 timeframe. And it was just, they basically tell you, don't answer the questions. If people ask you how much dues are, tell them instead how much of a benefit they're going to get. And, you know, if they ask you to leave, you know, say this. And, you know, I mean, it's just, they train them to operate this way. And then they reward them for operating this way, because a lot of times they, you know, in another one, there was like a $100 bonus if you brought back a certain number of signatures, or, you know, you get, you know, $50 in a turkey or something, you know. So there's incentive for these organizers to collect as many signatures as possible, because they reward them based on how many signatures, how many signatures they get. So, you know, with no oversight out there in the field, armed with these tactics that they're trained by, and then you reward them for this behavior by giving them money and bonuses and such. I mean, it's no wonder that this is happening with such, you know, to such a degree, because it's what they're supposed to do. This is what they're trained to do.
I might have missed it, but how did they get your name? Do you have to register with the state, and the state offered your name, or did you literally have to sign up? So your name is through the state.
Yes, the state, in every single one of these cases, they get the list of the providers, whether it's home care or child care, through the state. In very few cases, the home care and child care providers are not notified that their information was given to the SEIU. They don't find out until the SEIU shows up at their door, you know, and that's if the SEIU is even honest about who they are when they're there. You know, so there's no notice given to the providers that their information was given out.
Man.
It's your government at work for you. That's your tax dollars at work for you guys. That is what it is.
Crazy stuff, yeah. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, you know, because I had caught the story about the Harris case a few years ago when she initiated the lawsuit. It was, happened to have been something that I talked about on the show, but it was just a brief clip that I did. And then I moved on to another subject, not knowing how much in-depth this is and how far it had spread. And I think I would say probably 99% of the public is completely unaware of what is happening around them.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, they really have, I mean, and it's not their fault. I mean, the media is not covering it. And when they do cover it, very few cover it accurately. You know, it's portrayed as though these are workers who want to unionize. And then, you know, here in Minnesota, they tried to make it sound like we were these child care centers, like we were workers in child care centers. Well, in that case, at least we would have an employer to negotiate with. We're not employees at all. We're small business owners. And, you know, I always asked these elected representatives who were trying to force this on us, how can you require me to pay the self-employment tax and then turn around and require me to pay dues because you're calling me an employee of the state? You know, it's just, it was like the worst of both cases. But yeah.
Have there been any repercussions for you not joining the union? Have you had any feedback or negative issues occur?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the first things that they did was, you know, they labeled me a right-wing extremist, a tea bagger, you know, tea partier. I mean, all these, you know, like everything that they could throw at us. Our governor, you know, has called us right-wing extremists, and which is really laughable because the person that initially founded our coalition is a Democrat. She's still a Democrat to this day. Well, for the most part, I think she's coming around a little bit, but, she caucuses with them. I mean, she's a delegate for the Democrats. So to call us right-wing extremists, I mean, this has bipartisan opposition in this state. The only place that it was partisan was at our Capitol. And our governor also accused us when we filed our lawsuit, he accused us, strong business women, as throwing little fits. Throwing sand in the machinery, which he did that in the media. I mean, this was printed in the media. That was his quote. So that's our classy governor here in Minnesota. Unfortunately, that's what we've had to deal with for the last 4 years. I'm hoping that, hoping that he's up for re-election this year, and he's got a great guy, Jeff Johnson, running against him. I'm hoping that we have a new governor. It's very offensive. Not only is he implying that we're not capable of running a successful business as women, but he's, you know, accusing us of throwing little fits for standing up for our rights that are guaranteed to us by the U.S. Constitution. So, crazy.
Well, I guess we're just going to have to get his opponent, Jeff Johnson, you said his name is? We're going to have to get him here on the air before Election Day. But I can understand your frustration when you have all those epithets hurled at me. I mean, I have my own county council doing that to me. I have my own state senator doing that to me, Lindsey Graham amnesty. So I know exactly how you feel. They see me coming into the county council chambers, and they're like, oh, God, what are we in for today? And sure enough, I have my own council members calling me a Tea Party extremist when I was representing a bipartisan group.
That seems to be the catchphrase now. If you unless you're, you know, on board with $15 minimum wage and out there promoting Obamacare, you are a Tea Party or right wing extremist.
Thank you for my call. Good luck to you, and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Vito. And Vito has his own show here on Blog Talk Radio. Kel, what's the name of his show?
The Vito Esposito Show, Mamma Mia, No Sharia, Monday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Be there.
I knew you could rattle that off. I couldn't.
Bye, lady.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter, for calling in. Appreciate it. He's been ranting in the chat room the entire time. That's why I yelled at him to tell him to call in.
Vito is great. This man, Vito covers the gamut of everything, believe me. When he calls in, he sure has something to say, and you're going to learn.
Yeah.
The same thing with our undergraduate professor friend. Jennifer, this has been absolutely fascinating, and definitely have you come back again. Let us know where the lawsuit is going and what everything else is going on, because this message definitely has to get out. And I think Dan is going to be putting something up on Pundit Press, I believe. He's writing it as we're doing the show. So multitasking.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Jennifer. It has been a great pleasure, and I will be speaking with you and have you coming back on. I appreciate it greatly. Okay. Thank you so much. And your website is childcareunioninfo.com.
Right. And for PCAs as well, we've got a sister website, PCAunioninfo.com.
Oh, okay, great. And you're also up on Twitter, and you also have a Facebook page. And the Facebook page is called Child Care Providers Who Are Happy to Be Union Free.
Correct. Yep.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Jennifer. It was an honor to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
All right. We're down to our last 5 minutes here, guys. And want to give me any little bit of your input before we start getting ready to sign off?
Oh,
well,
my gosh.
Yeah, me and Dan. Oh, gosh. Hey, Dan. We're both spitting at the, you know, we're both spitting nails here. But I'll just say quickly, I've never been a fan of unions. And believe me, after this show today, everything that I feel about unions has been reiterated. And, oh, Jennifer, wow. Have her back, Annie.
Yeah.
There, Dan.
I mean, I had no idea how far-reaching this was until I started doing the research, and I'm glad I tripped across, you know, her name and the lawsuit. And having remembered done the story a number of years back when I first started the show, I said, wait a minute, this sounds familiar. And then as I dug more, and I said, no, this, I've got to get into this. I definitely. And was very pleasantly surprised. Very pleasantly.
You know, what was really great was how everything she talked about went further than what the original topic was going to be, dealing with unions in general, and how you can see whether it's the teachers' unions, the public sector, private sector, they all have the same goal in mind, and that is for the betterment of the union, to raise more money for the union, and do absolutely nothing for the workers that they're supposed to represent. And thus, that's why, you know, unions are not needed today. The time has bypassed them completely, and it's, you know, it's time that people realize that unions don't serve any function whatsoever in the 21st century.
Yeah, the behemoth, the dinosaur, is dying, and they're trying to keep it alive on life support.
Exactly.
At our expense. Hey, listen, we got coming up Friday, we've got your friend, Colin Flaherty. He's going to be on with us. And then next week, we're going to have Veteran Canine Corps, Vet Dogs. They're going to be joining us. That's an organization based out of New York that helps veterans get therapy dogs. And I'm going to have a musician from Germany who writes highway hymns and outlaw anthems, Ed Vintage. And then on the 23rd, we're going to have Usama Daduk, and we're going to be talking about jihad.
Wonderful. I haven't spoken with Usama for quite a while. Yeah, he has his radio program on the Radio Jihad Network as well, Saturday nights at 10 p.m. He is a fascinating person. Everybody, Usama, all the guests Annie gets, they are wonderful people. I'm particularly excited about Colin and on Friday. It's going to be a great month, Annie and Dan. You know that?
Yeah, and we're going to end the month on the 30th. On the 30th, we're going to have Congressman Mark Sanford on. So the only thing I don't have anything for is the 26th, but we'll see what we can fill in over there. Or maybe we'll just talk
about Dan and I will sing and dance.
Well, I want to wish everyone a good week and hope you come back with us on Friday, same bad time, same bad station. Good night.
Good night, Dan. Good night, Annie.
Good night, everyone.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense, the proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. Let's make it loud, Americans.